KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country are providing testimony in Washington, D.C. this week on American Indian and Alaska Native programs. Three hearings are being held in the House Committee on Appropriations, Subcommittee of Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies. Tribal leaders Tuesday morning mentioned how the Trump administration's recent actions, including the federal hiring freeze and layoffs, threaten essential services in Indian country. Tribal leaders are raising concerns about federal funding for healthcare, law enforcement, education, and other services. While tribal leaders are calling on the federal government to uphold trust and treaty obligations, Chief Jay Allen of the Coeur d'Alene Tribe is also urging for strong leadership.
All I'm asking is for leadership for us to come together and work this out.
Allen echoed funding needs for tribal programs, which he says have been historically underfunded, and urged the subcommittee to address tribal concerns. The hearing continues Tuesday afternoon and hearings Wednesday and Thursday. According to the subcommittee, there were an unprecedented number of requests, needing a third day to accommodate around 100 tribes and tribal organizations. The state of New Mexico announced Monday that state agencies are launching support initiatives to help people recently dismissed from their federal employment as the Trump administration seeks to shrink the federal workforce. The initiative includes recruitment events, online resources, and access to education and training opportunities. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says the state is committed to supporting people into transitioning into new career opportunities. Online resources offer information about unemployment insurance, job search, and career support. Recruitment events will take place in the state in the next couple weeks, featuring employers ready to hire, including the state and local governments and private businesses. New Mexico's congressional delegation has been advocating for the protection of federal employees, including those serving Indian country. A new sponsorship program in Nevada is seeking to get more tribal citizens covered and protected from accumulating debt from uninsured medical care. Alex Gonzalez has more.
According to reporting from KFF Health News, while some tribes already participate in Nevada Health Link's program, they're wanting to get more on board. The initiative allows tribes to buy health insurance through the state's Affordable Care Act marketplace. Advocates such as Jim Roberts with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium contend the sponsorship model increases access to coverage by giving Native folks a chance to search for medical care outside the tribal care system.
I think sponsorship programs bring case management to that process to allow people to understand what their options are so that they can get enrolled. Left to their own devices, this is a segment of the population that might not traditionally enroll in Medicaid or in insurance program.
Roberts adds that because sponsorship in some tribes isn't limited to just enrolled tribal members, it can impact whole communities. But he's worried that under the Trump administration, enhanced tax credits for marketplace enrollees will sunset by the end of the year if Congress doesn't extend them, meaning premiums could go up significantly. Proponents say the sponsorship program is making a difference for Native American patients, but more work is needed to build community trust. While Nevada Health Link used Washington State's program as reference, Roberts says the Silver State's approach is different.
But in terms of Nevada really getting behind it and asking the QHPs to work with tribes to set these up, I think that's unique.
Roberts wants to remind folks they won't lose their Indian Health Service coverage by participating in the sponsorship program, but will rather help fill in vital gaps in the healthcare system.
By providing resources that can then get billed for the care that they're receiving. And likewise, those resources can be used to expand care to the tribal population as a whole. Then it's a win-win situation.
I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA. DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com, who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Thing that I thought was stable, that I finally was like, oh, I'll have some stability, has actually been the most unstable thing that's happened to me. It just feels like nothing is really safe anymore.
Even federal workers in far-flung Kotzebue are among those laid off by the Trump administration. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Fairbanks residents rally in support of Ukraine to mark the third anniversary of Russia's invasion.
I'm here today to support my ancestors and their fight for democracy. And Ukraine's fight for democracy is the world's fight for democracy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel, March 4th and 5th at the Yupit Bijigiahait Cultural Center to develop federal wildlife proposals and discuss other subsistence issues. A special outreach session with North Pacific Fishery Management Council regarding chum salmon bycatch will be held in the evening of March 4th. Visit doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
All seven members of the Alaska Senate's powerful Finance Committee on Monday proposed rewriting the payment formula for the annual permanent fund dividend, renewing the Senate's effort to replace an obsolete state law that has not been followed since 2015. The Alaska Beacon reports that if signed into law, the bill would split the annual transfer from the Alaska Permanent Fund to the state treasury. 75% of that transfer would be reserved for state services, and the remaining quarter would be used for dividends. This year, that's worth about $1,420 per recipient, according to estimates by the Legislative Finance Division. The effort to rewrite the formula faces long odds, though. Members of the Alaska Senate have supported the 75-25 split proposal since at least 2017, the year before lawmakers enacted the annual permanent fund transfer. At that time, legislators said the dividend formula would be addressed at a later date, but no new formula has garnered sufficient support to become law, and in the meantime, the dividend has been set by fiat each year, becoming the capital's biggest annual issue. For the past 2 years, the dividend amount has been based on the 75-25 split, even though the new formula has failed to become law. The 2024 dividend was boosted by an additional energy relief payment. A new report paints a bleak picture of the impacts of frozen and canceled federal funds in Alaska. The report was released today by the 4-Acre Group, which supports Alaska nonprofits and tribal organizations. Lori Wolf, president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, said during Talk of Alaska today that nonprofits provide an especially wide range of services in Alaska due to the way the state is structured.
We don't have a county system of government in our state, and so our nonprofits fill the role that county governments would fill in other states. By design, nonprofits fill the gap that either government can't or won't do, and it's not viable in the marketplace.
That means the Trump administration's move to cancel or freeze congressionally approved funds and grants has a broad impact. Nonprofits in Alaska provide health care, public safety, food security, and in some cases even electricity. Of the more than 300 nonprofits that responded to a survey from the 4-Acre Group, half said a funding freeze could shut down their organization. Wolf says that right now, many organizations still have no clarity around whether their federal grants will continue, despite court orders to release many of the funds.
Even if they have been able to access some of the money, which right now they should be able to access all of the money because of those stays from the court, we know that some of them still cannot, and we know that a lot of that is based on the unclear language in the executive orders around their definitions of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Shortly after Talk of Alaska this morning, a federal judge granted a preliminary injunction to the National Council of Nonprofits, extending a temporary restraining order that prevented the Trump administration from moving forward with the freeze. But given the number of groups saying they still can't access their funds, it's unclear whether the Trump administration complied with the restraining order. Probationary federal workers based in Kotzebue joined thousands of other employees fired earlier this month by the Trump administration. Among them was a recently hired park superintendent with lifelong ties to the region. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
6 months ago, Socorric Whiting applied for her dream job as superintendent for the Western Arctic Parklands, managing a nearly 9-million-acre area that spans across three national parks. After a lengthy process, she was selected in early January out of a nationwide pool of dozens of applicants.
It was really humbling because I know there are a lot of people that have a lot of organizational experience within the National Park Service system. So it was very humbling, very exciting.
Whiting had previously served as Northwest Arctic Borough Mayor and Executive Director of Kotzebue's tribe. She is Inupiaq and a lifelong resident of the region, and says the superintendent position was something she worked towards her whole life.
So I thought about this in high school. I should work on ways to build relationships with our Indigenous people and the federal government.
But on Valentine's Day, Whiting received the news. She had been fired, along with around 30 or so other probationary Park Service employees statewide. The mass firings are an effort by the Trump administration to slash spending by downsizing the federal government. Whiting says the news gutted her.
I felt like I had the worst breakup of my life. Just breakup, no rhyme or reason why.
Whiting says it took her about a week to process the news before she was able to talk about it.
But then you can't just keep going with your life feeling like you're in doomsday. So I finally get my strength back and hope and think about what my parents would do, and my parents would persevere. They'd keep going on no matter what's happening around them.
The Federal Workers Union expects at least 1,300 federal employees in Alaska with probationary status to be fired, according to reporting from the Alaska Beacon. These employees span a variety of departments, including Veterans Affairs, military, transportation, and agriculture sectors. The layoffs could also affect seasonal and part-time employees, like federal firefighters. Rachel Heckerman worked as a seasonal employee for the Park Service. As a visual information specialist, her job included working on graphic projects specific to the Western Arctic Parklands, like website development, river guides for visitors, and videography. She was fired the same day as Whiting.
Working under like a Inupiaq superintendent, I was so excited about that. Just to like be within a Park Service community that has somebody that represents the community truly, to see that completely ripped out in under a month, that honestly I think was more of a blow than me getting fired.
She says she found out by email, which notified her the firing was based on her, quote, poor performance and failure to demonstrate qualifications.
It's insulting to find out that it's your poor performance, even though I have paperwork and documentation that completely proves otherwise.
Heckerman says another blow was losing her health insurance, which expires in a month. She has a chronic medical condition that requires daily medication. Heckerman says, in addition to doing a job she loved, which blended her passion for science and art, healthcare was a huge motivation when she accepted the job over 3 months ago.
The thing that I thought was stable, that I finally was like, oh, I'll have some stability, has actually been the most unstable thing that's happened to me. It just feels like nothing is really safe anymore.
Heckerman says she's fortunate. She has enough medication to last a while, and she works remotely. For some, especially federal employees who live in rural Alaska communities, losing their job could also mean losing housing.
Some people moved across the country and then essentially just got fired and like have no housing. If I lived in Kotzebue, I would have lost my housing. And that's really alarming.
Heckerman says she is now looking for employment and might resort to freelance work. She says she's scared to take chances with another federal job out of fears that it could be eliminated under the current administration. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, farmers in Delta show support for Governor Dunleavy's proposal to establish a Department of Agriculture.
Farm Bureau, this has been the number one priority on their list for 30 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A woman at a park in Anchorage's Mountain View neighborhood died last night after police say she was shot from outside her motorhome. Police say officers responded to the shooting at Davis Park on Mountain View Drive just after 7 p.m. A bullet had entered the vehicle and struck the victim in the chest. Medics took the woman to a local hospital, where she later died. Police have not yet released her name and say they are still notifying her family. Officers spoke with witnesses at the park, which currently hosts a homeless encampment, but have not yet made any arrests. Police ask anyone with information about the shooting or surveillance video from the area to call them at 311. A couple dozen Fairbanksons rallied on a main street corner yesterday in an impromptu marking of the third anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. KUAC's Robin reports.
They waved Ukrainian and American flags and carried anti-Russian banners and signs. Women had sunflowers in their headpieces, wrapped in yellow and blue ribbons over their coats. Sveta Yamin Pasternak says Alaskans need to take note of what's happening in Ukraine because they have much in common with people there.
And I think especially it is relevant for all of us as Alaskans because we truly do share the same values with Ukraine. We also, unfortunately, are currently sharing a hostile neighbor.
She held a banner that said, "Solidarity, Alaska and Ukraine, many great values, one bad neighbor in common." Ryan Tinsley held up the other end.
You have a full-on assault against Western democracy. You know, led in part by Putin and his misinformation. And I think there is more and more in common with the fight in Ukraine.
Stacy Fritz has joined a small group on this street corner several times in the last 3 years. She's hoping for peace, but she doesn't think it will come through President Trump.
His first effort to make peace excluded the Ukrainians. That's the opposite of sincere good effort to make peace. And today he refused to go along with the UN resolution condemning Russia for illegally invading Ukraine. Sure, everybody wants the war to end. There's a simple way to do that. Russia and Putin can get out of Ukraine.
Zelensky is offering to step down from his position if Ukraine will be part of NATO, which is showing the whole world that he's not a dictator, but he is the true president who actually cares about his country and the true peace.
Katerina Verbeska is a dual citizen of the United States and the Czech Republic.
Because we were occupied by the Soviet Union for over 20 years. So that's one of the reasons why I'm here, to support Ukraine, because I know how it feels. I lived under the occupied country just for a little bit, but I know it from my parents and, of course, from the history.
She joined in singing a traditional Ukrainian song that has become symbolic for resistance against Russia after it was sung on a main square in Kyiv a few days after the invasion on February 24th, 2022.
I am half Czech myself. My father was a Czech refugee who escaped from Soviet Union. And I learned a lot about the importance of fighting for a cause.
Musician Paul Krejci played because he said music is a way to build solidarity and show where one is standing on an issue. He feels betrayed by a giant reversal of U.S. policy toward Ukraine. President Donald Trump is bargaining for Ukraine's rare earth minerals and last week withdrew weapons and financial support for Ukraine's fight against the Russian invasion.
I think many people who have grandfathers, grandparents who fought in World War II would find this revolting. It's traitorous, I would say. And to have the President of the United States leading this cause, it is something that's a sucker punch, you know, to those who have fought for freedom for this country since its birth.
He started up the song again and was joined by Marianne Babbage. She's Ukrainian-American, born in Chicago after her parents fled Russian occupation 90 years ago.
I feel terrified and impotent. That's why it was so good to sing that song. And I'm still kind of choked up about it, honestly. And I'm here today to support my ancestors and their fight for democracy. And Ukraine's fight for democracy is the world's fight for democracy.
Hey,
in Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
More than 100 people showed up Saturday for the 53rd annual Delta Junction Farm Forum, and most who showed up expressed strong support for Governor Mike Dunleavy's proposal to establish a State Department of Agriculture. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
It shouldn't come as a surprise that a room full of farmers and ranchers favor the governor's proposal, but many of those in attendance, like longtime area farmer Ruby Hollenbeck, said the proposal isn't really to create a new agency, but rather to reinstate one that had been in existence in territorial days.
In 1945, the Alaska Department of Ag was created. Prior to statehood, there was a territorial commissioner of agriculture who headed the Alaska State Department of Ag.
Hollenbeck said the department was folded into the State Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, back in the early 1960s. She and others believe that's because Alaskan leaders were focused on developing the state's oil and gas reserves and less attentive to producing food.
So it then became a division under DNR, and that's when the struggles happened.
Alaska Farm Bureau President Scott Mugridge says he and other farmers who came to Delta in the 1980s have for years been asking for an agency dedicated to the agriculture industry.
Farm Bureau, this has been the number one priority on their list for 30 years.
Dunleavy advisor Andrew Jensen said the governor's proposals intended to restore a cabinet-level commissioner to support the industry and improve the state's food security.
But we're trying to really be proactive, and I think that that's what this agriculture executive order really represents. It's a continuation of these efforts.
Mugridge says the new department would give the industry the authority it needs to thrive.
You know, we've got to take a little bit of responsibility back on ourselves.
Yeah, big wave here. About 6:30, we have a school board meeting coming up, so stay tuned. Be prepared and all that.
He said in an interview that Dunleavy's hope will support the proposal to get the new department up and going by July 1st. But lawmakers like Anchorage Democratic Senator Matt Klayman says many voters see education funding as a higher priority.
How do I make the case to them and say, this year it is so important that we fund this new Department of Agriculture that we need to take $2.7 million away from what we could put toward education and put that toward this new department.
But Jensen said the governor feels strongly that the time is right. He says even though money is tight, the cost is a small price to pay.
When you look at something like food security, which is what this Department of Agriculture is to address, you know, priorities, this is one. And I think when you look at the cost of it, it's pretty reasonable for the mission that it's intended to achieve.
DNR has seven divisions that oversee important sectors of Alaska's economy, like oil and gas, mining, and land and water, all of which can make it hard to focus on agriculture.
The way it's structured now, the division does compete against other priorities within the department. Food production should not compete with oil production in terms of being a priority for the state.
Jensen said $2.7 million will cover salaries and other expenses needed to stand up the agriculture department, and most of its staff would come from the current agriculture division.
DNR has over 1,000 employees, and we're going to be moving 37.
The legislature is expected to vote on the governor's proposal by March 22nd. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Seward's roughly 60-year-old cruise ship dock is on track to get a $140 million makeover. That's after the Alaska State House passed a bill last week that ups the amount of money developers have to work with. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, stakeholders say the project will revitalize aging infrastructure and expand regional economic opportunities.
Where the frigid waters of Resurrection Bay lap at the edge of Seward, two strongholds of Alaska tourism meet. The iconic blue and yellow Alaska Railroad reaches the end of its tracks in the small town, which embraces its slogan of Alaska Starts Here. It's also the starting point for visitors coming by sea. Everyone seems to agree that the Alaska Railroad's existing cruise ship dock and terminal has seen better days.
The dock is clearly nearing the end of its useful life.
That's Jane Pearson, speaking to members of Alaska's House Finance Committee last week. She works for the Seward representative carrying the bill to up the debt limit.
In over 50 years of use, the dock's pile foundation has corroded, and there are now limits on the dock's remaining useful life, and weight restrictions are being implemented.
If it passes, the bill would more than double the amount of bond debt the Alaska Railroad Corporation is allowed to take on to get the project done, up to $130 million. The corporation needs legislative approval to sell any bonds, kind of like how a city or borough needs voter approval on bond initiatives. Alaska Railroad CEO Bill O'Leary says the project's benefits would go beyond Seward. The corporation estimates that more than 200,000 cruise ship passengers visited Seward last year, with many adding on to trips in other parts of the state.
And it is not just a South Central project, not an interior project, but it does immediately impact both of those sectors. But it also has a significant impact to the Southeast market, providing an avenue for cruise ships to come across the Gulf.
And Seward City Manager Kat Sorensen says the terminal is designed for year-round use, which makes it appealing to the city and community for off-season access.
Over the past few years, as this project has been explored and discussed around town, I already hear the Seward community planning and scheming up amazing ideas to work with the railroad, hosting events and community gatherings in the tourism off-season.
Sorensen says the railroad's plans also dovetail nicely with the $46 billion federal grant the city got last fall to add shore electricity to the dock. The bill currently moving through Juneau actually made it across the finish line last session, but there was a hiccup. It was one of five bills passed by lawmakers after midnight on the last day of the session. Pearson says the bill's timely passage this session is imperative to ensure construction can continue as planned and so Royal Caribbean Cruises can honor trips it's already started selling.
They've already started selling bookings on the ships. Just by having this bill vetoed last year, it was really put a stop in the whole project.
Royal Caribbean is an important partner in the project. The company would enter into a three-decade agreement and become the anchor tenant at the dock, which is designed to the specifications of the company's ships. Royal Caribbean will then use its dock revenue to pay the debt off. Preston Carnahan is the company's regional vice president of destinations. He says the new dock will be able to accommodate the Royal Caribbean's Quantum class of ships, which are the largest sailing in Alaska.
We're excited as a visitor to your state to continue to bring a lot of happy guests on our ships.
If all goes according to schedule, construction on the new dock will start fall of 2025 and be completed next spring. Now that the bill has cleared the state house, it heads to the Senate. Reporting in Soldotna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race kicks off this Saturday with a parade-like ceremony through downtown Anchorage, but the route is significantly shorter this year due to the lack of snow. Race officials announced today that the ceremonial start will end at the Sullivan Arena instead of the Campbell Airstrip, making the route about 1.5 miles instead of the usual 11 miles. Andy Angstman, the Musher representative on the Iditarod's board of directors, says it's disappointing to lose so much trail, but he's happy to have any sort of ceremonial start. That's because Anchorage is having a historically low snow winter.
I was personally surprised they were able to find enough snow to truck in to do any kind of ceremonial start, so I'm pleased they were able to pull that off. The fact they were able to get any snow at all is a bonus.
The ceremonial start will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday. The 33 teams will leave the starting line at 4th Avenue and D Street at 3-minute intervals. They'll head down 4th Avenue, turn right onto Cordova Street, continue down the Cordova Hill, and then turn left on 16th Avenue and end at the Sullivan Arena. After the ceremonial start, mushers will truck about 350 miles north to Fairbanks for the official race start at 11 a.m. on Monday, March 3rd at Pike's Waterfront Lodge. Race officials moved the start to Fairbanks because of Bear Trail on part of the route out of Willow. The 2,500-mile Iron Dog Snow Machine race finished in Big Lake on Saturday, and as KNOM's Ben Townsend reports, the race had an unusually high number of scratches, thanks in part to that unseasonably snowless section of trail.
With hands pumping in the air, Team 20's Bradley George and Robbie Shackle ride side by side for the final quarter mile of this year's Iron Dog Snow Machine race. They wait until the last possible moment to slow down. Race director Mike Vassar greets them as they pull into Big Lake.
Let's have a big round of applause for Team 20. Good job, guys. You're 2025 Iron Dog champions.
Vassar hands a microphone to George moments after he crosses the finish.
Thank you to everybody who put this together. Mike, all the volunteers, everybody that is a part of Iron Dog, making this happen, everybody that supported us, sponsored us, family, friends. Thank you guys so much for making this happen. This is awesome.
A standout feature of this year's race was an unseasonably snowless 60-mile stretch called the Farewell Burn, which forced teams to stop and wait for their overheating machines to cool down. Vassar says the burn added over an hour to average course times. Roughly half of this year's 30 teams made it to the finish, the lowest since 2020 when just under half of the field finished. Other finishers included Team 14's Casey Boylan and Brian Leslie, who came in second for the third year in a row. Rounding out the podium was Team 7's Tyler Acklestad and Aaron Lawyer. Team 4's Wilson Hogendorn and Bubba McDaniel made waves in their first Iron Dog appearance. The duo from Nome finished 6th and were named Rookies of the Year. This year's Iron Dog included over $250,000 in prizes, with the top team taking home $80,000. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Madeline Rose, Chris Clint, and Ava White in Anchorage, Robin in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, and Ben Townsend in Nome. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line 1, your health connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
crash on the levee, mama, water's gonna overflow. Swamp's gonna rise, no boat's gonna roll. Now you can train on down to Williams Point. You can bust your feet, you can rock this joint, but mama ain't gonna miss your best friend now. Gonna have to find...
Director Matt, and we have Holly Stiles and Grant
Roof.
And Austin Roof.
A minute. She'll be back.
That will be returning soon.
And Jeff Little's binder.
In the staff white room, we have Cheryl.
Megan. Yes. And
we have Braden and Nabai.
Braden and Nabai.
Yeah. Others online?
We have KSD Pete, David Nielsen, Karen Ravenscroft, and I believe that's everybody.
I hate to do this. Approval of agenda.
This is for another week.
Approve the agenda.
I'll second.
By Hillary, second by Brenda. Roll call.
Perlene.
Yes.
Freya.
Yes.
Carla.
Yes.
Hillary.
Yes.
Brenda.
Yes.
Amy.
Yes.
Motion carries.
Are there any public comments on agenda items? And King Cove?
Here. We have Holly Stiles with a public comment.
Okay, thank you.
There. My name is Holly Stiles, and I have a child who's on the agenda for the acceleration, and I just wanted to make a really brief comment about that. 2 years ago, Hannah missed being in kindergarten by 2 weeks, and so she went to preschool, and when she started kindergarten last year, she really excelled just as beyond expectations. And this year, she's really been thriving in the second grade classroom under Lynette's guidance. And her teachers agree that this is where she needs to be. And her father and I agree this is where she needs to be academically and socially. And so she hasn't met one specific, very specific acceleration criterion, scoring very, very close to it, but not quite, with the psychologist's margin of error noted twice in his report. And so she's exceeded in other benchmarks as well, including placing in the top 5% on her MAP scores. And so we just would really appreciate your consideration to keep her where she's at. She's spent the entire year with the second grade class, and she's demonstrated her ability and readiness for this level of learning in the second grade classroom. And I would just ask that the school board consider the full picture of her thriving in the second grade and move to keep her accelerated where she currently is. Thank you.
Thank you, Holly. Are there any other comments on agenda items?
Well, as her second grade teacher, I did have her as kindergarten. And so I'll just back up what the mom says. And if you guys need specifics, I can talk to you about those. Or if you have questions, I'm more than willing to talk to you about those. But I just wanted to let you know that she has been in my class kindergarten and now second and third grade. She's with the second grade group and she's doing really well. And so if you guys want to go over more specifics, I just want to let you know that I backed up her mom.
All right. Thank you, Lynette. Any other comments? Okay. Get approval for minutes, January 20, 2025, regular meeting, and also February 17, 2025, special meeting minutes.
Can we get this as a block?
Yes.
I'd like to approve this as a block, the January 28, 2025 regular meeting minutes and the February 17th, 2025 special meeting minutes, please.
A second.
Roll call.
A.
Yes.
Zemi. Hillary.
Yes.
Rhea.
Yes.
Carla.
Yes.
Brenda.
Yes.
Carlene.
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Student report. I believe her report is in our packet. If the report's in your packet, next is the any board reports.
Carly, I have one for the legislative fly-in.
Hi, me, Shane. Hazel and Ellie went to the legislative fly-in, and it was really fun. I think the kids had a lot of fun. They met some other kids from around the state. I learned a lot. I met a lot of school board members. I met our lawyer, John Cedar. He was pretty. He was pretty cool. He was pretty funny. Yeah, this is the first time I've been to this, and I just kind of sat back and watched, and I learned a lot from. I think I learned more from just talking to other school board members from different parts of the area, state. And yeah, thanks for sending us there. We had a lot of fun. And we got to meet with, what's his name? I don't know why I can't remember his name.
Grace Edgman.
Oh yeah, Edgman. Yeah, that was pretty cool. The kids got to talk to him. There was one thing that Hazel said when we're listening to other people, like, when the kids were making like their mock testimonies and they were practicing their testimonies, a lot of the kids were saying like they wanted more funding, like they don't have band in their school anymore or art, like these things are going to be cut. And Hazel said, I just want heat. And yeah, and then you know, she said, "We just need a maintenance man," which kind of stood out. Which is, I thought was just kind of cool of her to say. We're talking to another school board member at our little table, and she said, "Well, what would you ask your representative?" I'd ask them just for heat in their class because our boilers weren't working for a while. Luckily, they are working now, but I just wanted to share that with you guys, and thanks for sending us there.
All right, thanks, Carly. Next is the superintendent's report.
Thank you, Madam President, board members. It's nice being here in King Cove for a meeting. It's nice having a former King Cove, Sandpoint, person here with us as well.
I'm also born and raised on the Rock.
So fluid back and forth.
We got two more back there, born and raised.
We have many dual citizens.
So it's good that I have meetings back and forth. So I'm glad to be here. So I'm going to start. I always put quotes on my reports and I never read them. And I'm going to start reading them because I love them. So I'm just going to read this one from Walt Whitman to start out. Books are to be called for and supplied on the assumption that the process of reading is nor a half sleep, but in highest sense, an exercise, a gymnast struggle. So I love this because it's a good reminder this time of year that we do really well with this with athletics, where we practice and work hard to get better. And sometimes we forget that, you know, academics is the same, that it's a daily struggle. And daily practice is what leads to improvement. And so when we talk about the staff in service coming up, that was a big focus of the staff in service, was talking about that daily practice with academics and having more of that, frankly, an athletic mindset towards our academics. A big part of the day for the K for that 217 in service for the K-5 staff was to learn about some ELA curriculum options for adoption for the next year. So our staff is still reviewing those options. We had four different presentations from four different curriculum options for K-5 ELA. And we'll continue reviewing that over the next couple of weeks, and we're getting feedback from staff. And I'm hoping that we'll be ready for to propose one to adopt for the board to review in March. A lot of great options. And again, our focus is to make sure it's aligned with science of reading, requirement from the state of Alaska. And then also we want to make sure it's one that's accessible for teachers and students and parents, of course. Also at that in service with the staff on February 17th, we had another session in the morning with Aaron Hansen, who wrote Heroes Within. Remember, that was part of a grant this year that we got where we could have him work on resilience building skills for our students with our staff. So we were going over more chapters from his book. I think one of the things, the big takeaway I had from this round is he talked about the idea of back mapping. We know that when kids have purpose in their life and see a vision for where they're going in the future, they do better. Not a big mystery. So back mapping is just a strategy where they start, you know, instead of building a map to move forward, they kind of start with what their maybe a goal is and work backwards to say, well, how would I get there until they get to the present. So it's an exercise we can do with our kids to help build purpose in what they're doing. I thought that was pretty engaging. I'll highlight the next couple sections quickly. Obviously, a big conversation right now is we're in budget season, budget building season. We know we have some enrollment drops, and we know we're going to have to make some decisions in staffing moving forward. To kind of add to that struggle, on February 14th, we received a Dear Colleague letter from the U.S. Department of Education to school districts, which implied that our title funding might be at risk moving forward if we continue with our current practices. We're being assured, so just so you know, like title funds for our district account for over $240,000 in revenue. We use it to fund our aides in our classrooms and after-school programs for our students and some professional development for our staff. So there is nothing certain yet. And that's during budget season, a lack of certainty is a challenge. Just know that this is something I'm watching closely, along with other superintendents. The Commissioner of Education for the state of Alaska, Dina Bishop, sent a nice reply to the Department of Education, along with some other superintendents, advocating for more local control of those funds, and I'm hoping I will advocate for the same thing. I think it's a good avenue where I'm hoping we won't lose those federal funds for our kids, but maybe have more local control of what we do. So just so you know, I'm paying close attention to that, and stay tuned. HB 69, which I talked about last month, is the Representative Himshue from Sitka, who was a former Sandpoint teacher. Is the author of House Bill 69, which advocated for over a three-year period an increase to the BSA of $1,808, which would essentially be keeping up make our BSA equal to what it would have been if it had kept up with inflation from 2011. That would put us in a very comfortable position if that could go through. It has moved forward in the House. We know we have support for it in the Senate. So that's encouraging news. The governor's made it clear it probably won't sign it, but it's encouraging. We know we have a lot of support for more education funding in the House, right? We had already had it in the Senate. I just have a brief summary of my travel coming up. It's quite a bit this time of year. I just spent the last week in Falls Pass. This week I have the opportunity to be here in Kinko and celebrate this wonderful regionals tournament with the staff and students here. I'll be going to the legislative fly-in for superintendents at the end of March. And then part of me taking over federal programs this year is I'll be going to the ESA Consolidated Application Workshop in Anchorage. And it works out real well that I'll go from Juneau to that, so there's not extra plane tickets going back and forth, and I'll go straight from that to visit Accutan. So trying to save some money on travel by combining all those trips. Always having gratitudes. This goes out, I'm going to make a general one. Sorry, no specifics, but to the general and to the community of Falls Pass. I always love visiting there. Matt Brown's doing an amazing job. It was great seeing a multi-age class. He's teaching pre-K. We now have a pre-K student there. So Matt Brown's teaching pre-K to 10th grade, all in one room, with an aide who's doing a great job too, and Mr. Tepper, Father Andre to some people, you know. And they've brought in, you know, really great art programs. They have really great differentiated instruction for all the kids. But it's really, although I appreciate Matt, this is really a gratitude for the community of Falls Pass. The reason why it works is that the community comes into the school to make lunches once a week because we don't have a lunch program there. The community donates time to help with that maintenance that, you know, the girls were talking about. The community comes in. Matt had a parent meeting while I was there, and pretty much every parent in the community showed up, and they had great ideas, and they were really involved and active. So a community like that only works if the people, the parents, are super present and active. I got to see Reagan running the NYO practices after school, and it was just, you know, again, multi-ages in there. I definitely got humbled by Ellie during the NYO practices. But it was great to see after school activities, all this great stuff happening in a really small center. And that's because of the community. And it was great hearing, you know, I was really pleased that some of the high school students were able to travel from Falls Pass this year to some of our athletic events. And then to have Ellie and Hazel go to the fly-in, and I got to talk with them about that afterwards and just seeing the confidence that grew in them by going out into the big city and being a part of that. It was really inspiring, and it makes me really want to advocate to make sure that our students from our small sites get to be involved in activities as much as possible. That's my report. Thank you. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to address.
Are there any questions? None. Thank you for your report. Next is the district correspondent. And first on the list is King Cove. Karen, you're up.
Hello. I would say the two major things that have happened here is And we spent a lot of time getting ready for regionals, and a lot of people have been involved in a lot of different ways. So I appreciate how people have come together, you know, not only the teachers here, but the students and people from the community have really pitched in and contributed in a variety of ways. So that has been a really gratifying experience to be able to be part of that. We also had a lot of good professional development that happened in the last month. People went to conferences. I myself went to one in Anchorage that was really interesting in terms of incorporating more technology into our classrooms. So I appreciate that I had the opportunity to do that. So other than that, the details of other things that have gone on are in my report, but I feel like the next report with reports on how all of this went will probably dominate my next one, because there has been a lot of planning that's gone on in this last month.
Right, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, next up is Sandpoint. Scanlon. Wherever you come up here.
Stand back here and talk loud. I'm in person tonight because I have my seniors, well, some of my seniors here for the senior trip that we're requesting. But as far as my report, things that I didn't include that I just wanted to touch on a little bit. Mike mentioned the backward mapping. I was able to be in the classrooms for that project that the teachers led on the high school side. And it was really awesome to watch. The kids had some great things put down, and there was some good thought put into it. It was awesome to see just the difference in them from 7th to 12th grade. So that was really great. Also, the teachers are doing some great things in the classroom. So I walked through for Friday electives. You know, we have kids making pajama pants. We have kids putting plays together, embroidering, making greeting cards in coding class. There's actually, I've been told, going to be links for those in our Friday flyer this coming week so that they can be clicked on and see. They have animation and stuff to them, so that's really cool. And then Dennis doing the ATV stuff is actually expanded to vehicles in general. And the kids were fixing the shop truck last Friday, or the school truck last Friday, so that was really cool to see all the heads around the hood. Well, it's the hood was popped. Anyway, it was really cool just to see that going on. And then Ms. Tilo had a virtual field trip happening in her classroom. And so I think that's second, third grade. And, you know, when I go in and they're having, it was, I can't remember if it was, I don't know if it was fishing game or one of the national parks. Anyway, he was having the kids, you know, do some art things and just some different things. And the kids had some good questions. So lots of really cool things going on in the classroom. And then Miss Jenny just recently had her students teaching the community how to plant gardens. And so there were quite a few community members that were able to plant seeds and get a garden start taken home with them on Saturday. So that was really cool. The gratitudes I have, we just had a Valentine fundraiser for the seniors so that they could get most of the rest of their money for the senior trip. And we had a great turnout from the community. But what I was even more thankful for was the parents that showed up and helped with Amy getting injured. A lot of this has fallen on me because we were kind of co-advisors and now it's just me. And so it was really stressing me out. I haven't cooked for that many people before. So to have Jane and Charlie and Karen show up and just help with the whole thing and help direct the kids where they were supposed to go, it was awesome. Dinner turned out great. I didn't hear anything terrible and nobody got salmonella. So good job braiding on the grill. So I'm just thankful to everybody that helped with that. And Julian, I'm assuming you played good music. I was in the kitchen the whole time, but nobody threw anything at you, I'm guessing. So all good with the music. And then the other seniors were, you know, the waitresses and then helping in the back. And it was just super awesome. And then last, we've had two really great subs that have been super dependable this year and in the building. Well, three. We haven't had Erica for a little while, but Chanel Hernandez is new to subbing in the building this year, and she has been absolutely awesome to come in and take over preschool for Danteza and then go and do like 7th, 8th grade PE at the end of the day. So that's been really awesome. And then also Leah Yeager, which everybody knows, she has been back in the building a lot with Danielle.